Seriously.
Founder of EA coming on We Talk Games. The show is a juggernaut.
It is happening. Hey, thanks for being on the council, guys.
Thank you.
Talk to you next month.
See ya.
Did I mention Trip Hawkins was going to be on next month?
What?
I don't believe it! See you later now.
Bye.
Bye. Up to now, We Talk Games only has 2 points on the King of Kong triangle. Let us complete the trinity. Open a line for Steve Wiebe, Keith. Redmond, Washington! Steve Wiebe! Welcome to We Talk Games. Go!
Hey, thank you very much for having me on.
It's great to have you. The most famous algebra teacher, I think, since Algebra himself.
Algebra. That's what I have a character in my class I use. His name's Algebra. Yeah, I have a buddy named Matthew Maddox. So I kind of play around with the names.
Fantastic. I hear that you're almost as popular as Pi in some circles.
Yeah, in some circles. Hey, that's pretty funny.
Well, I don't know. I'm at a little bit of a disadvantage because I didn't see the late show with Craig Ferguson, so I don't know what was already used up. But speaking of that...
No, you didn't get that one.
Okay, very good. Speaking of that, though, competitive gaming. Now, you were the first to hit over 1 million in Donkey Kong, and your high scores really brought you to the dance, but wow, King of Kong, I think, brought you and many other competitive gamers to the world. I mean, what an impact. What has come, besides Late Show with Craig Ferguson, I'd love to hear about that, but what has come out of this whole King of Kong movie movement happening?
A lot of things have blindsided me. I mean, I never thought something like all the things that happened would have happened. There was talk before the movie even got made, like, you know, what's going to happen with this? I was asking the director, he was like, I don't know, you know, we're hoping we sell it, but, you know, the very least we'd have some great home movie, you know, like when you look kick back 10 years, you can look back on a little home video of our family during this era.
Sure.
So we thought at least that would come out of it, but we never expected the things that did come out. The one that first was touring the film festivals, a lot of people had copies, like kept burned copies of the CD was making the rounds, and Tony Hawk had got a hold of the copy.
Oh.
And emailed me. He was like one of the first celebrities that even touched base, and he emailed me on eBay through an eBay account, and I wasn't sure if this was a real or it was a fraud.
Right.
And I researched it and asked one of my friends, and they thought it was real, and so he sent me a skateboard signed by him and a couple of video games for my son. That was really, really cool that he reached out, and I met him at Spike TV Awards, and met him also at the premiere of King of Kong in L.A. a couple years ago. So he's a great guy. And then from there, just kind of spiraled, just kept be sitting on the couch at 6 in the evening on a Saturday, and I get a call from Matchbox 20, Rob Thomas's manager, so on the phone, and they're all in the backstage somewhere, you know. And he's saying, well, the band would like to have you come down, and we're in Seattle tonight. And so we just jumped in the car, me and my wife and my brother, and just went down there, saw the show, met the band. Alanis Morissette was back there. She had opened for them. Met Alan White, the drummer of Yes.
Wow.
The same. He was back there with the band.
Were you a big fan of Yes? Because I know that you're quite a good timekeeper on those drums there, that's for sure.
Yeah, I like Yes, I like Rush. Kind of, yeah, those progressive rock bands were big when I was, you know, in the 80s.
Sure, sure.
I love that genre. So that was cool meeting them. And then, you know, My Chemical Romance, which is a little younger crowd. I hadn't even heard of them when they emailed me. The bassist, Mikey Way is his name, and emailed me and wanted me to come down and play on stage with the band, actually. And I was... can believe it, and I told my students, and of course they knew who My Chemical Romance was.
Sure.
They're hip on the new music, so I drove down to Portland on a weeknight with my friend Mike Thompson and met the band, and they, instead of playing a song, they said, well, we actually not going to be able to play a song because we didn't rehearse with you, but would you mind doing a drum solo? So I kind of was a little in shock.
Wow.
So I go, oh, well, okay, cool. And then there's like 2,000. It was kind of a small venue, the ballroom, it's called.
Sure, but over 1,000 is still...
it was a great crowd. And they were going crazy. Their crowd's totally nuts for for them, and they're jumping up and down on the floor when they're playing. And I don't know if how many people actually knew who I was, but the lead singer announced me, and they still went crazy, even if they didn't know who I was. And I went there, got on the stage, and did about a 5-minute drum solo, and they were still screaming and stuff.
Wow.
I don't know how much of it was just because they were just psyched just to be at their favorite band's concert, or if they actually enjoyed my drum solo, but it was a great experience. That's most people I've ever played for. Back when I was trying to make it with a band in Seattle, you know, we'd play for maybe 2 people, the bartender and the sound guy.
I've been there.
So it was definitely a different taste. And then from there, Vince Vaughn was a big fan of the King of Kong, and Seth Gordon directed 4 Christmases.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I had the opportunity to make an appearance on that in that movie. It was kind of a wild... I got a phone call from Seth, and my wife was at home, actually, and Seth said, well, you won't believe this, but they want Steve to come down and be in the movie 4 Christmases I'm directing. There's a small part, non-speaking role, but I went down there for 4 weeks, had to get time off from work, from school, had to make all these arrangements with this school district.
Sure.
So it was just crazy trying to get that set up, and totally wild experience just on a movie set, just a total different world.
Yeah. I was on the set of Hairspray, so I know a little bit of what it was like, but I wasn't, you know, featured like you. I got to run things a little bit behind the scene, do a little extra work and stuff like that.
Cool.
But yeah, well, what a compelling story, King of Kong. I mean, you can't write the characters that you really are. And what characters to play off each other, Billy Mitchell, yourself, those personalities, Walter Day's personality, and all the other very unique personalities that definitely are brought to light in that movie, as well as other video game movies as well. But I think there's really no better movie that pulls on the heartstrings. I mean, it's good for the whole family. People that don't know anything about gaming get so involved. It's such a... Let's face it. Your scores would have been a very compelling plot device. Like, if you were just writing a movie. Like, you know, here comes this guy, not involved with the competitive gaming movement of the earlier years. And, you know, he's very humble. He's a teacher. And here he comes out of nowhere, unassuming. And... These scores are real, and that's what's amazing about it. So these people are real. These stories are real. I mean, of course, there's some movie making going in and brilliantly done, but I've had Walter on a show. I've had Billy on a show. Now you are on a show, and I could have the guy that created video games, like the first video game. In fact, we have had him on the show. And yet, no matter what, it's the people involved with King of Kong, the biggest pop, the most reaction from our listeners, from my friends, when I tell them, you know, who's going to be on the show next, I could tell them, you know, this guy made billions and billions of dollars, the most successful video game company, most successful overseas, the biggest transaction, whatever. It doesn't matter. This guy brought us Tetris. It doesn't matter. It's this King of Kong crowd that is more famous, more popular, and resonates more with the people. It's amazing. So what are you doing now? Now I hear that you're actually doing something with your music. I told Walter that he should get a hold of you and do some type of video game high score all-stars or something and do something live at the next convention.
That'd be fun. Yeah, I'd like to jam with Walter. Walter is kind of, it's eerie that we had a similar passion for music, and how we both have personalities are the same, kind of mellow and don't want to create controversy, and we get kind of pulled from each direction. As in the movie, you can tell that we're kind of battling different people are trying to pull us in different directions. So it's kind of funny that we're kind of like a similar, and we definitely are friends, and I see him here and there when I go around, and I've had the opportunity to go for world records on Donkey Kong. It was the latest one was last summer in June. I was on at E3 going for it on live television, and it was on G4 network, and there was people that were watching it, I had to take a couple days vacation to go to LA, and my class was watching it, and other teachers' classrooms were watching me on TV going for Donkey Kong. So it's kind of funny. But going back to Walter, I think, yeah, he has to definitely get his music in gear. He's had hundreds of songs in his head like I had.
Sure.
And I just finally was able to get my CD done. It's been 10 years in the making. It's kind of paralleled the King of Kong in many ways, trying to get my music done, just running into different walls and trying to go this way and get cut off. And eventually, I got it done, and the CDs will arrive Thursday, I believe. I was trying to get them before Christmas.
Okay. But,
and they'll be available on iTunes and other stores after the new year. So I have a website out that you can go order the CD from. And on AOL Radio, I was had a blog of my top 10 favorite songs. They wanted me to... And I had Rush was the Camera Eye was my number one song on there.
Fantastic. So yeah.
If you go to AOLradio.com, you can see the blog that I put up. And then there's a link to go and order my CD. So it's 11 songs. I think that's a great job. I hired a sax player, guitarist, and a singer. Everything else I do the drums, piano, and I composed all the lyrics and the music.
Oh, fantastic, fantastic. Well, we sing King of Kong. You rocking your kid's set there. Now,
yeah.
Was that Derek's set, or was that...
Yeah, that was Derek's. It was a little mini kit that my parents had bought him.
Sure, sure. One of our most popular songs that I did with my group Trapdoor, we had our drummer come in, and for whatever reason, he brought his son's mini drum set and laid down the live drums over top of something that was a pre-existing song for quite a number of years, and it sounded fine when we, mixed it in the studio, but I'm sure in the studio you got out your full set of Zildjians and Pearls. What's your drums of choice?
I play Gretsch and Zildjian cymbals, yeah.
Fantastic. Well, I got it half right.
Yeah, that's pretty good. Yeah, so I prefer Zildjians.
How about the hi-hats? Are they Zildjians as well? Or
hi-hat Zildjian, yeah. What I did when I've always played Zildjians, and then I looked online when I went and, some of them were cracking, and I looked and saw what Neil Peart kind of rides and hi-hat he had. So I pretty much bought the size that he had, like a 22-inch ping ride. I can't remember exactly, but the same New Beat hi-hats that he was using. But he changes. He used to play Tama drums, and then he went into Ludwig, and now he's playing DW, I believe, now.
Okay, very good. Any other big drummer influences?
Stuart Copeland, John Bonham. Those are, some of the main ones.
And what do you think your genre of music, what style of music is the album all over the place, or is it, do you stick?
Yeah,
do you
have... it's got a lot of influences, pretty eclectic. It's got, I like Steely Dan, and if you go to the AOLradio.com, you'll see a lot of the influences on that page. So I know I got some, the saxophone, kind of influence from the Billy Joel genre, and then the piano bass, the Elton John and those types of influences are on there. But has definitely, you'll hear a Rush influence with some of the drumming and the rhythms that I have. So it's just got a little bit of everything, and that's kind of keeps it kind of unique, and from track to track, it keeps it more interesting rather than this one sound throughout the whole album. So I think it'll be good. It has a little bit of something for everybody.
Great.
There's even a violin, kind of a country backwoods song. It's not your modern country song, but it's a kind of a backwoods where you have the snare beat going.
Sure. Yeah. The railroad beat.
Yeah.
Something
the
like
railroad
that.
Beat going with a backwoods kind of fiddle. So it's it's kind of funny how it's got a little bit of everything.
What's the name of this album?
It's called The King of Song.
What?
Play on words. I wasn't going to name it that, actually, but when I finished recording it, the singer I hired signed it to the King of Song, with a Sharpie when he gave me the CD to review of the mixing. Looked at it, and I didn't say, I just kind of, that's kind of clever, and then I showed it to a friend of mine, and actually, I didn't show it to my friend. He mentioned, you should name it the King of Song, and I go, that's funny. My singer just signed it, the CD, saying the King of Song, and he goes, you should definitely do that, and then another friend of mine have the idea of me at the piano with my fist raised in the air, much like the cover of the DVD for The King of Kong, where I'm at the Donkey Kong. And if you remember the cover for that, so this one I'm at the piano in my living room.
Fantastic.
I have my hand up in there. So
in the living room, the photo. That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's great. That's really great. Boy, what accessibility, this age. It's just amazing how these things can happen. Now, our producer, Kyle, he doesn't sweat competitive gamers. He knows that he can beat pretty much any competitive gamer because he uses Game Genie. Takes him about 13 minutes to plug in his 52-digit code, and he's off. He's good. What do you think about that?
Oh, in 13 minutes, beat what his Donkey Kong score is?
He could beat any score with his Game Genie.
I must be out the launch on what's, I haven't heard of the Game Genie. What's that?
Oh, Game Genie was very popular back on like the Genesis and the Super Nintendo and the 8-bit Nintendo. Galoob brought it out, and you plug in a code and you can cheat on any game.
Oh, I think I remember Derek actually ordered one. I don't think it's called the Game Genie. It was something, the Game Shark. There was one other.
Yeah, Game Shark is new. Yeah.
Game Shark, yeah.
Those are the newer ones. But back in the day, now what got you into competitive gaming?
Well, I actually didn't even know there was this culture existed. Like you said, you mentioned in the movie, I kind of got thrown into this community of gamers that I really don't fit into.
Mm-hmm.
So I was just, didn't really know there was much competitive gaming at all. And I was just going for my own high scores, trying just playing Donkey Kong for the fun of it, actually. I bought my own machine in college, had my fraternity, was getting in the 500,000, kind of got up to 700,000. And that summer, I took the game home and hit this screen that killed me off. I didn't know what happened. I was at the screen, and Mario just tumbled and died. And I thought there was an invisible barrel or some kind of higher level of difficulty that prevented you from really getting much further in the game. And I went there, I played again. I was curious to get to that same screen because I was trying to break a million. This was back in 1990.
Wow.
So I was at 967,000 on that game. And then I got there again, and I had two lives left. So I died, and I went again, and the next Mario died, and the game was over. So I realized that was the same level, but I thought there was some bug in my own game, so I pretty much didn't play, kind of put the game away, left it in my parents' upstairs, and then ended up selling it because I wanted to buy an electronic drum set when I was in a band, and it was like 1993, and we're trying to make it big, so I sold it. But 8 or 9 years later, I was just browsing through the internet because back in 93, there really wasn't any online data for video game scores, and then I just saw that there was a high score on Donkey Kong, and it was like in the 800,000s, and I knew I'd beaten that, so I figured I'm going to go ahead and buy another machine. And Nicole was cool with that. She didn't know exactly this was gonna, how far it was gonna, all the mess it was going to create, but so I went and was able to get right back on. It was like riding a bicycle. It took me maybe a week or so to get back in the groove. So I found out the Twin Galaxies on the internet had the scores, you know, kept the record. So I submitted a videotape and broke the record. So that was really not really an interest in trying to compete with anybody. I was always just curious of what the high score was because I knew that I'd gotten to this screen that killed me off. And I was like, I wondered how many people have actually gotten that high of a score. And it turned out there weren't that many people. So I was kind of surprised. I figured there'd have been more people. So that's how it kind of happened. And once I submitted the videotape, if you've seen The King of Kong, I know you have,
mm-hmm.
but the listeners, you'll see what kind of controversy that that led into.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. In fact, we even joked a little bit about glitches and tapes and things like this. So not from your tape, but from other tapes that were shown on that movie. And I got to just ask, I mean, is Derek now of the age where if he sees that wipe my butt segment, does that upset him at all? Or
yeah, I haven't watched that part with him in a while, but I know when we were first going to all the film festival that came to Seattle, the Seattle Film Festival, and we were sitting in the theater, and that part came up. He was getting anxious and started getting embarrassed, and he was crying, so
sure.
We had to take him out of the theater. So that kind of upset him, but I think, you know, now, yeah, I don't know how he'd react if he saw the scene, but, you know, when he's in high school and he's got his... he's coming back from a tolo or a date, and they sit down and watch. I don't know how it's going to go over with his girlfriend.
Yeah. Well, hopefully it'll make him a much stronger person. But I got to tell
you,
I mean, you can't help but laugh at it. It's one of the most just hilarious, no matter how many times you see it. It's just so innocent and adorable. And everyone has been there, I think. Everyone has been, not to the extremes of going for the highest score ever, but everyone has been in the moment of something, and then something completely unrelated and totally unexpected and important comes into their lives. So it just resonates, I think, on so many levels with so many people, and that's probably why you've attained the fame. Too bad. I know how fortune does not always go along with fame. I mean, it's just hilarious how you keep saying about how you have to schedule off from work, and I know exactly what you're talking about. I can have people all over the world come up to me and say congratulations on this, that, and the other, and, you know, I still do the jobs and little things and work for nothing, basically. So,
yeah. It's fun. It's just a great experience. I'm not really a materialistic person. I'm very happy with the lifestyle I have. So fantastic. It's just great to meet new people and have experiences that you wouldn't have normally. So
definitely,
that's worth a lot of money in my book.
Very good. Very good. Excellent. And great morals for you kids out there listening. Why did you get into arcades? Just because it was in your dorm, or did you used to frequent arcades back in the 80s? Or
yeah, I grew up with, you know, the Atari 2600, I believe it was, the home console, and you'd go to the arcades on the evenings or the weekends and drive down to 7-Eleven, or back when they'd have them in 7-Eleven.
Sure, yeah.
Arcades in the neighborhood. You said, you know, hop on my bike and ride a couple miles, ditch out on my chores I was supposed to do, and drive and play video games. And so that was just what we grew up doing. And then when we got older and in the mid-80s, when the arcade started phasing out, you know, and started playing sports in high school, kind of went away from playing video games. And when I went to college, there was one of my fraternity, actually a friend that was in a different fraternity, had a fraternity brother that had a Donkey Kong in their fraternity, and went over there, and I looked at it. I was like, I remember, you know, I loved Donkey Kong, and I still did, but I hadn't seen a machine in probably 5 years, and there was a guy playing, and I thought to myself, well, I got to buy myself one of these now. This is too cool. I can't believe that someone actually has their own Donkey Kong. So I went and bought one in downtown Seattle and put it in my fraternity room, and there was about six or seven of us that played religiously in there, and a couple guys could get in the 200,000 range, and so that's where it all stemmed from.
Right on, man. Hey, well, what's in the future? Back to school? Success with the King of Song?
Yeah, those things. I still love teaching, so I plan on doing that for the rest of my life. And yeah, hopefully I can get my music out there, and I don't know what to expect, what will happen with that. Just hoping people can hear it and enjoy the music. Whether I get anything out of it monetarily or not, it's not a big concern. If I can get some money to back so I can record another CD, that'd be awesome.
I'm sure you'll do that. iTunes is pretty good. It's pretty steady. For some reason, you can still get checks every month, and it's very nice. It's very unexpected, and with the success that you've had from this movie and that propelling you, and that's already advertising right there. So I mean, that's a big part of it that I surely never had enough left over to take care of. So I wish you all the best success.
Well, thank you very much. Yeah, I'm looking forward to see what happens. Nowadays, the internet has just opened up all the avenues that we didn't have back in 20, 30 years ago. And if people can hear it and enjoy it, that's what I'm hoping for. So,
thank you. Right on. Well, thank you very much for being part of We Talk Games. We hope to talk to you in the future.
You bet. Thank you for having me on.
Bye now.
All right, bye.
Find out everything about Steve Wiebe at stevewiebe.com. That's W-I-E-B-E, or you could just click on the show notes of this episode. Hey, I'm excited to have 2PIR on. Let's open the line, Keith. Let's start wrapping this up. Sherman Helmsley Oaks, Los Angeles, California, 2PIR. 2PIR, welcome to We Talk Games. For the first time, 2PIR is joining us.
Thank you, Wiggly, and hello from the wild and woolly West Coast.
Right on, man. Now, 2PIR, you have surprised me because...